There's something wrong in the country of childhood.
I was really struck by the lack of one particular sound when I was in indigenous communities. And it's the sound of angry, frustrated children crying. There is something about the way that indigenous cultures bring up their children that creates an extraordinarily happy sense of childhood. I was also very struck by that sense of children in American, Euro-American traditions, which, although they have a kind of cornucopia of richness, and although there's so much pressure on parents to examine the welfare of their children, and yet there is this devastating sense of childhood unhappiness.
That's Jay Griffiths. We spend the hour with her talking about her book, A Country Called Childhood. It's a powerful plea to nourish children's independence and reconnect them with nature. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Why are so many children so unhappy? The incidence of mental disorders among children is soaring, and while it's not clear exactly why that is, it seems intuitive, at least, that the kind of social pressures kids are subject to are at least part of the picture. Too much homework, not enough time to daydream. Too much scheduling, not enough time to explore on one's own. Too many screens, not enough trees. And just maybe, too much meddling by well-meaning, anxious parents, and not enough benign neglect. My guest, writer Jay Griffiths, says the modern world has enclosed the enchanted commons of childhood, subjecting kids to top-down control that prevents them from truly experiencing the world and developing a healthy sense of self. Kids have lost the liberty to roam, something I remember was precious to me in my childhood, when I could jump on my bike and explore the neighborhood at my leisure, or sit in my favorite tree several blocks from home and read and daydream undisturbed. That loss, along with a severance of kids' connection to nature, has wrought untold harm, says Griffiths in her book, A Country Called Childhood, Children and the Exuberant World. The New York Times called the book almost shockingly beautiful, a profoundly felt, deeply thought, fiercely argued examination of childhood. I spoke with Jay Griffiths last fall, just before the book was published by Counterpoint. Jay Griffiths is the author of several books, including Wild, An Elemental Journey, and Savage Grace, published in the UK and forthcoming in the US. Well, Jay Griffiths, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you, what moved you to write this book?
It was one of those things where when I was traveling for my previous book, which was about wilderness, which is forthcoming, called Savage Grace, I was really struck by the lack of one particular sound when I was in indigenous communities, in the Amazon in particular. And it's the sound of angry, frustrated children crying. It was the same in West Papua, the western half of New Guinea. And this is something that travelers, historians, anthropologists have been saying for hundreds of years. There is something about the way that indigenous cultures bring up their children that creates an extraordinarily happy sense of childhood. I was also very struck, and I have been for years, by that sense of children in American, Euro-American traditions, which, although they have a kind of cornucopia of richness, and although there's so much pressure on parents to examine the welfare of their children, the well-being of their children, and yet there is this devastating sense of childhood unhappiness. And whether that's the deep, complex abysses of teenage depression or that kind of, you know, that bored, angry, kind of difficult childhood sense that so many families know. And it was, well, what is it? What is it that creates this chasm of a difference and has done, we've been told, for hundreds of years?
I remember talking to Jared Diamond about this. His most recent book for adults also talks about what traditional societies can teach us. And he recounts also experiencing children in traditional societies, and I think he's also in Papua New Guinea, that he's been there quite a bit, as being ones where the children are very, not only are they happy, but they're also extraordinarily self-possessed and self-reliant.
This is a really interesting point, because one of the things that I found when I was reading and talking to Indigenous people and looking at their philosophies is that if there's one thing there's an enormous commonality of agreement about, it is respecting the will of a child. And that sense of respecting the will of a child really builds up a child's sense of self-control. And it's quite interesting, because you could say that, you know, if you let a child have its own way, you know, it'd be a complete disaster. You know, these kind of infant gods kind of wreaking havoc, total chaos, you know, selfish little, you know, brats running around everywhere. But in fact, the sophistication of the idea is that if a child's will is deeply respected, they are also going to be better able to respect the will of others. That is the second half of the trick. And this is where what you get in any really functioning society is you get both individualism and collectivism. And that's a very interesting line to take through all this. I was also looking at the way that will is associated with wildness. You know, will is like a kind of iridescence within the human spirit, within human nature. And that kind of sense of what is wild in land, what is wild in nature, is also wild in the human spirit, that independence and that self-control. And so, as I would see it, that when people can sometimes talk about the importance of obedience in childhood, the importance of order, the importance of control, I would say that the true opposite of obedience is not disobedience, it's independence. The true opposite of order is not chaos, but it's self-control. It's, you know, those things, it's freedom, independence, and self-control, rather than the sense of being controlled by another.
So what went wrong? I mean, in your book, you really pin, I think, the idea of this loss of a natural childhood to enclosure, to the enclosure movement, to the you know, the 17, whenever it started, I guess it started back in the 1500s, but certainly gathered speed in the 16 and 1700s. Tell us about the enclosure, and what is the connection between the enclosure and the enclosure of childhood, the transformation of childhood?
To me, this is completely fascinating, is that some of it looks like it's kind of, you know, British history, long, long, long time ago. But it's one of those things where the philosophy of the enclosure movement is with us every single breath we take. And I was looking at that idea that, yes, as you say, the kind of 15th century, the 16th, 17th, 18th century, at its height in the 18th century, there was this sense of the ruling classes enclosing land, privatizing it for the profit of the wealthy, taking away what the commoners needed to survive. But it was also a metaphysical thing, that childhood also became very much enclosed in those years, enclosed in discipline. And what we see now is a sense of children enclosed in time, you know, that ferocious overscheduling of children's hours, the refusal of reverie. So when children naturally have this, you know, they hate punctuality, that a childhood which daydreams is seen as something which has to be policed, that has to be coerced and in a way, you know, alarmed out of it. So people talk of if at the absolute best using a planner for pre-planned fantasy periods. This is not the freedom that children need in time. They're being enclosed. And obviously, what I'm really aware of is that parents and teachers are doing this out of love, out of care for their children, not wanting their children to get behind in the rat race that begins in the nursery. This is a really understandable thing. But the effects on children are stress, depression, a sense that they'll never keep up, you know, the kind of the over-testing of very small children and the, you know, the stress that children feel at school. And it's a society-wide problem. You know, I'm not interested in saying there's good parenting and there's bad parenting. It's about what society has done to childhood in general that makes it so impossible for parents to feel able to respect that kind of release, that sort of, you know, that those long hours of play, you know, the latent, incipient imagination, which in fact psychologists know is incredibly good for children. It's incredibly good for their sense of self-control. Again, that idea, which is very important to me, not that children are controlled by others or by the clock, but by themselves. What psychologists say is, I realize there's a long answer to a short question, that what psychologists say, children need private speech. They get that not when they're playing with toys that they've bought from shops, not when they're scheduled into time, but when they can allow themselves to flip into that unplanned reverie of their own thoughts, when they're looking at a box and deciding, you know, is it a house? Is it a tree? Is it a nest? Is it a train? Is it a boat? And it becomes whatever they want. It's not a toy that already has its identity given to them. And in that, they know the richness of imagination. They're not in the world of beggars, in the world of scarcity, which they are when they have to buy their toys from a toy shop at a price. This is unpriced and therefore priceless play.
And in fact, Jay Griffiths, in your book, you connect this to capitalism, to the need to make profit. I mean, we know the enclosure movement, as you said, the ruling classes enclosed the commons for their own profit, but it wasn't just the ruling landed classes. It was the rise of the industrial machine. It was the imposition of the clock. I believe it was the English historian E.P. Thompson who talked about the replacement of feast days and carnival days. Many, many days in the year were feast days, and now you had the imposition of time because you had to have people come to work on time. On this point, in this wonderful book, A Country Called Childhood, you talk about this poet who was writing just on the cusp of that change and who wrote about it, a man who ended up in an insane asylum. John Clare was his name. Tell us about him and you know, what was his story that reflected this larger story?
John Clare, to me, he's the patron saint of childhood. He's the patron saint of childhood when childhood can live in nature. And I don't mean kind of, you know, thousands of acres of rolling hills. I mean some nature, some green stuff, some trees. He had an extraordinary sensitivity to the landscape around him. He was a peasant poet. He was absolutely not part of the hierarchy of metropolitan literary culture. But what he wrote about was the exquisite beauty of birds' nests, of trees. There was a particular tree that he regarded as his friend, as many children do, actually, of kind of taking their troubles to a particular tree to climb, to sit and to remember, in that way that children almost seem to recognize that they can trust a tree, that a tree has a sense of truth behind it. And that is one of my favorite pieces of etymology.
I had such a tree as a child.
Yes, so did I. I had a tree in a nearby park. You know, mine was absolutely not a rural childhood, but there was a park nearby. There was a tree I used to go climb up and sit in and read. And I loved that tree because nobody ever looked up. So I could sit in this tree with a little flask of water and a sandwich and an apple and read and read and read. But what I was going to say, this link between a sense of truth, a sense of trust in trees. Those words are etymologically connected. This is really beautiful to me. The word trust, tree, truth, betroth, in fact, tryst, endure, they're all related words. So John Clare, the poet, had these powerful relationships with birds. He kept a pet sparrow, taught his cat not to kill it. The pet sparrow was called Tom. You know, he had these incredibly intimate relationships with creatures, with nature. And he was writing just on the cusp, as you say, of the enclosure movement. It utterly broke his heart because he felt that neither he nor any other creatures had a nest anymore. None of them had a home, and he treats himself almost as an animal. He had a very indigenous understanding of the land, that not only he knew the land, but the land knew him. And it's almost as if through him, this is where we see not just the nature of childhood when it could be on the commons and free, but the heartbreak of that when it was broken.
You've written this book. It's just extraordinary language. And I'd like you to read a little section here that goes right to the heart of what you've just said, the nest and how important this is, but not within the context of 18th century England, but in Australia, among the Aborigines of Australia. So it's just a short little excerpt from your book. And maybe tell us what the context is here.
At the start of my book, what I wanted to explore was the profound ways, not just in language. Language tells us through Latin that birth, nasci, to be born, is related to natura, nature. But so do so many indigenous philosophies associate early childhood in general, but particularly that sense of being born into the land, into the earth. The Maori word for placenta is the same as the word for land. In West Papua, it's so beautiful is that people would talk about digging up potatoes as a kind of birth, that they were being born from the earth down from the earth up into the light. In Indigenous Australia, traditionally, there's this incredible sense of the sophisticated, intricate link between the child when it's born and the natural world that it is born into. There's a belonging there. There's an exquisite sense of connection, of story, of communion.
And how did you get to all these native lands and work with these indigenous people?
Well, it was when I was writing my previous book, actually, which is in America going to be published after this one, so everything's slightly backwards. So when I was researching Savage Grace, I wanted to write about air wilderness, fire wilderness, earth wilderness, ice wilderness. And so for each of those, I wanted to stay a certain amount of time with different indigenous communities, living in communities of ice. So I went to the Arctic, living in communities of earth. So I was staying with Amazonian people in the forests there. And I also spent some time with Indigenous Australians right in the center of Australia in the deserts.
And that is a great segue into this segment here, into this excerpt from your book, A Country Called Childhood.
In the traditions of the Australian deserts, even from its time in the womb, the baby is cat's cradled in kinship with the world. Born into a sandy hollow, it's cleaned with sand, it's smoked by fire. Everything, insects, birds, plants, animals, is named to the child, who's told not only what everything is called, but also the relationship between the child and each creature. Story, kith, and song weave the child into the subtle world of the dreaming, the nested knowledge of how the child belongs. The threads which tie a child to the land include its conception site and the significant places of the dreaming inherited through its parents. Introduced to creatures and land as to relations, the child is folded into the land, wrapped in country, and the stories press on the child's mind like the making of felt, soft and often storytelling, until the feeling of the story of the country is impressed into the landscape of the child's mind. That the juggernaut of ants belongs to a child belligerently following its own trail, that the twitch of an animal's tail is part of a child's own tale or storyline once and now again, that on the papery bark of a tree may be written the songlines of a child's name, that the prickles of a thorn bush may have a dynamic relevance to conscience, that a damp hollow by a riverbank is not an occasional place to visit, but a permanent part of who you are. This is the beginning of belonging, the beginning of love.
That's so beautiful. I want to thank you for that. And also, could you explain what is a songline and what is the dream time?
Oh, what a huge question. Well, I think one of the things that I'd first say is I'm not myself Indigenous Australian, and I really, really appreciate that they have felt in the past really upset when some people have misinterpreted and misstated it. So with apologies if I do, what I would like to say how it has come to me is that the dream time, it's in the past, but it is not in a line behind you. It's not dead and over. It's more like a sense of time which surrounds the present. It's a depth of time. So it isn't dead. It's alive. The dream time is living. It's a past that is present in the land. One Indigenous Australian said to me, the past is alive and it's under our feet. It's in the land. It's present. And it is also something which is kept alive through myth, through ritual, in the present. And it's something which in turn sustains the present. So it's like the past, if you imagine it like a kind of envelope around us, like a numinous kind of presence surrounding the present. So the past gives vitality to the present, and it is in itself alive, which is one of the reasons why all kinds of mining on sacred sites is considered so abhorrent, because it's actually reducing the energy of the past, which sustains the present. The songlines is something where the ancestors in their story, crossing the land, maybe making a hollow to sleep, maybe stopping for a piss. It's very graphic, some of these things. Some stories of the ancestors to give birth, to have a conversation, following particular things, leaving their trail. These songlines left along the land are trails that other people now today, knowing these songlines, can find their way across the land. So they are maps in song. But they are also, Bruce Chatwin wrote about that, but he's managed to upset quite a lot of people because he looked at it as if it was only an aesthetic. And what Indigenous Australians have said to me is it is not only an aesthetic. It is, but not only. It's also law, L-A-W, law. And that is a very serious thing. So the law of places, the law of the interaction of people with place. So, for example, when I went to some places, people said to me, please come with us and we will introduce you to the land. But we would rather that, they said, than you went alone, because then the land doesn't know you and you don't know the land.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jay Griffiths about her book, A Country Called Childhood, Children and the Exuberant World.
So these are all resonant of what you speak in your book, this way of relating to the land, to one's history, to the sense of continuity is all kind of the nest within which children grow up and the landscape that they explore and must explore. So tell us about that urge for exploration and how important it is. And of course, you know, today's children are not at all allowed to do that. Even my son, when he was six, we lived in a neighborhood where I could let him, you know, I just tell him to go out and play, and he was fine, and he'd come back when he was ready. But I can't imagine his daughter, my granddaughter, being able to do that now.
One of the things that I think is a very, very serious issue is the fear of stranger danger. And I choose my words carefully. I'm not saying stranger danger, I'm saying the fear of it. There's an extraordinary statistic that if in the States, if you left a child unattended, how long would it take for that child to be snatched by a stranger and kept overnight? Some people might think a day, an hour, a week. who knows, maybe confident parents might say, well, 4 weeks. It's actually 750,000 years. That is how uncommon it is. That is what I mean by the fear of stranger danger. In Britain, it's 2.5 million years. But the important thing, it seems to me, is that there are so many losses that come about because of this fear. And I have to say, I have that same fear myself. It works on me as it works on everybody else. I have 10 children, I like to say. I can see your face on a disbelief when I'm going to explain. I have 8 godchildren, 2 nephews. I've had a lot to do with all of their childhoods, all of them, especially my nephews. And I know that if I have sole responsibility for them and I'm out somewhere, if they're out of my sight for 1 minute, I will panic. I understand the fear totally. But I need to say to myself, as I would to anybody else, this is a fear. This is not a reality. It's a panic. The media creates a false proximity so that if one child is hurt by a stranger, everyone understandably feels their child is under threat. It's not true. If one child is kidnapped somewhere, you know, in a country far away, everyone will feel that there is their child under threat. Well over 90% of the abuse that happens to children by somebody known to the child. That is where the danger lies. And it seems to me that this is where, you know, people have to stand up to this false fear as a group. I think people have to come to understand that actually what is taken away from children is a terrible, terrible theft. The freedom to be outside with other kids is incredibly safe. Of course, the fear of traffic, now that is a wholly appropriate fear, wholly appropriate. Children need parks where they can safely play, right in the centre of towns. That's what they need. Children need to be able to play out with other kids. Children need to know to trust their own instincts. So when they're saying, I think that person's a bit dodgy, that instinct is respected. You know, people need to get together to demand safer spaces in terms of cars, safer spaces for kids to play. Why are there so many places to park your car, but not parks for kids? And I'd also say, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I would just point out, who benefits from this so-called stranger danger thing? Who benefits? Well, first of all, the media, because as soon as there's a scare story, everyone wants to watch it on television, everyone wants to see it on the internet, repeat it, send it out. The other people who benefit, and this is much more subtle but is absolutely the case, is the toy and gadget industry. Because if you have children enclosed, indoors, passive, and bored, the word, incidentally, only invented, boredom only invented in 1852 by Charles Dickens, not needed before that when children had a far greater sense of freedom. When children are bored, enclosed in their bedrooms, of course they're going to need more gadgets, more toys. So the entertainment and the gadget industry really benefits from the stranger danger. So yes, when I say capitalism has a hand in this, we need to watch it a little bit.
You had a very different childhood, at least in the early part. Give us a sense of what your childhood was like, the explorations that you were able to do, and how that helped you grow as a person.
I think one of the most important things was that myself and my two brothers, one's 1 year older than me and one's 2 years older, so we were a little gang. That was the first thing. We were a little tribe, and with a couple of other, you know, friends of ours in the street, this and that. We could take a canoe, we could go to the river, we could go to the park. And it wasn't that we ever went on some massive adventure. You know, we didn't do what the wonderful young teenager Laura Decker did, which was to up sticks and sail solo around the world. I mean, how brilliant. We never did anything like that. But what we had was a freedom of scale to us, of how to wander off, how to kind of wander safely, how to find our own way around our neck of the woods. We also had, and I think that this is a really big issue, we also had a very profound sense of privacy. And everybody, it seems to me, always talks about the attention that children need. And I totally agree. Children need attention. They need love. They need watching. They need all of those things. They need witness. They need listeners. But children need time away from surveillance. Children need private places. Children need dens. You know, there's an entire body of literature which shows that den making is part of the universal child. It's genetic. We're programmed to do it. I have not yet met one person who can't remember what it feels like to make a den. Even if your childhood was a wholly urban, wholly indoor childhood, children will make dens with cardboard boxes, throwing a sheet over the kitchen table, whatever it is. Children need to do this, and preferably outside. Urban kids make dens on the scruffy bits, the bits that adults have forgotten, have overlooked. Rural children, if possible, will make dens in trees, in the kind of, again, the scruffy bits between the bush and the fence. And in those dens, they drift into an extraordinary place of self-making, of soul-making. They often don't want adults to watch them going in or coming out. That a den is like a cocoon for the child. They're becoming butterflies, and they move into this strange other place. They want often to take food there, to take drink there, to make it a kind of temenos, a sacred space. And it's not necessarily that they're doing anything productive. Often it looks from the outside as if they're doing nothing at all, and I would say that is exactly the point, because under the eyes of no one, they are gently allowing that sense of the unsupervised, the unsurveilled. Because, of course, as soon as you notice a child, they notice themselves. That's where self-consciousness steps in. That's where also the type of surveillance which I think makes young people intent on wearing their hoodies. Why do they do that? This is something that really fascinated me when I was writing my book. Why is it that the fashion for hoodies arose at exactly the same time as increasing surveillance?
I want to go back to what you said about finding that little cocoon, because it struck me that through daydreaming, through making a nest, through cocooning, that what children are doing is building up an interior space of themselves. And it seems that that's something that is increasingly lacking. People don't have a sense of who they are, of their interior life. Is that what you're getting at with this?
I think that's a beautiful interpretation. It's about the importance of the spirit, the human spirit. It's about how that spirit is best served in childhood. And the things about modernity which crush that spirit, and which crush that kind of, that sense of soul. Children have an extraordinary sense of spirit. I think everybody who listens to children knows that when they ask you kind of, do you believe in God? They really want to know. When they say, what happens after death? They're curious about this. Their sense of that is profound. They are philosophers. They live, you never need to teach a child metaphor, because it seems like something of that interiority, something of that inner self is with them right from the beginning. That's where they live. They live beautifully in the right hemisphere of the mind. The left hemisphere, of course, absolutely necessary later on for numbers, counting, calculating, logic, language, writing. Absolutely. However, it isn't the primary part of the mind. The primary part of the mind, the right hemisphere, is where children live first. That's imagination. That's metaphor. That's magic. That's jokes. That's intuition. That's a sense of the numinousness of the world. That's a sense of the sacredness of nature. Every child is born with a sense of nature and a love of nature. Somebody once said, the tragedy of the world, I was thinking about, nature and how much children love animals. You can't prize them away from that love of things. 80% of the dreams of children under six are about animals. They belong in that world, and they have a sense of empathic understanding. One of my godchildren, in a very secret, private moment, took me and showed me her snail hospital, where she, and only she, could see the cracks on snail shells, which she mended first of all with spit, which seemed quite safe, and then, unfortunately, with Tippex, which seemed less advisable for the snails. But she was learning empathy. She felt that she understood, perhaps completely wrongly, what those snails needed. But the point was, she practiced empathy with the living world.
Jay Griffiths. We'll talk more with her about her book, A Country Called Childhood, after the break. Don't go away.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and...
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour talking with writer Jay Griffiths about her book, A Country Called Childhood. It's about how we're destroying the soul of childhood by denying kids the autonomy they need to develop a healthy sense of self. But she also says we force very young children into too much independence when what they really need is intimacy. She decries the practice of controlled crying, where infants are left to cry without parental intervention. Griffiths says it does a world of harm.
This is really interesting. The first time I saw it at first hand, it absolutely broke my heart. It was one of the most frightening, horrible things I've ever seen. And it was a small child, it's a one-year-old. And the child's mother was such a kind, good-hearted person. There was nothing in her that did it to be cruel, to be unkind. She did it with the best of intentions. She'd been told that it was the best thing to do. The thing with controlled crying, where a parent is encouraged to leave a child to cry so that they will self-soothe, is the idea. They will learn that they can put themselves to sleep. The idea is that the parent may go in and check after a controlled set amount of time, that time increases, so the child has a longer and longer period in which to cry themselves to sleep. That the child is sometimes taught to cry, the phrase is, to extinction, in other words, until they just haven't got the energy to cry anymore. What people say sometimes is, yes, but it works. I don't doubt that it works. I've seen it work. That isn't the issue. The issue is, at what cost? Because if a child is being taught that they might suffer the most terrible pain of abandonment, which is a child's worst fear, we know this, abandonment, that the fear, the terror of that, the terror that I heard in that child's crying that night, that this floods a small child with stress hormones, cortisol, which they are not developmentally equipped to deal with. This changes the child for life, that when they're being taught to supposedly self-soothe, they're actually experiencing the most terrible rush of the worst kind of hormones. The parent's job is to de-stress a child, not to create, even with the best intentions, not to create that level of, you know, this wash of poisonous hormones, which leads to kind of, you know, it can lead to later self-destructive behavior, of alcoholism, of terrible psychological damage. You know, we know this from all the studies that have been done. And I do think that most parents, if they have seen the studies that I've seen, which I've put in my book with full references, would not do it, would realize that actually a child who's much more securely attached is going to be, in the long run, a much happier and also much freer child. That what they won't learn is that sort of sense of deprivation, emotional deprivation. They will learn a sense of abundance, of emotional abundance. That's what you get from the kind of, you know, the typical indigenous experience, which means that 93% of the time in one indigenous society where people have counted, 93% of the time a small child is in arms, whether it's the mother, the father, an aunt, a grandmother, somebody. that a baby is not ever left to cry on its own, that this is considered a horrible thing to teach a child, that they are abandoned, that they must cry until they're blue in the face. Indigenous societies seem to have a profoundly common, obviously not all societies are the same, it's a profound commonality of agreement that the best way with a very small baby and a small child is that they're kept as close as possible as long as they need it. And the interesting thing is that then, securely emotionally attached, they're really good as children about taking the chance to explore, knowing that they have this emotional safe base. So their sense of freedom in later life has this, you know, absolutely beautifully nested sense of the human heart within the kind of in arms early years, and then the later sense of freedom.
As I read this, I had to think about, you know, the choices that our society really foists on us. Most families can't make it economically without both parents working. And, you know, it was a very important victory for women to be able to step outside of the only mommy role and be able to live as full human beings. I mean, we can remember in the 50s when, you know, women were at home and, you know, living lives of quiet desperation because they had to give up their own lives because they weren't really supposed to work when they were mothers. So how can we fit this very important idea of giving children secure attachment in the early years in with the kind of society that we have?
That is a hugely important issue. What I'm looking at in my book is very much not what parents are doing wrong or right. It's absolutely what society has forced on parents. Also, without question, your point about women and work is supremely important. I think what I'd say is that what seems to have happened over the last few hundred years in Western society is it's the rise of the nuclear family, which is actually enormously problematic. When it works, everyone knows what's good about it. What is not so good about it is very seldom recognized, one of which, the pressure it puts on parents that, yes, as you say, kind of, you know, economic imperative, which forces, you know, for the appalling costs of housing, which really is a massive issue in my view, which forces people to take, you know, two jobs, three jobs, four jobs between two parents. This is absolutely outrageous. And of course, it's bad for parents, it's bad for kids. And so one of the things children dearly, dearly want is more time with their parents, more time to themselves. But the issue of the nuclear family means that the stress that is placed on parents and therefore on the relationship between parent and child can be so intense, it's kind of hot, grief-stricken often. The intensity is way more than that relationship can hold in so many cases. It's nobody's fault that it is like that. But if you have extended families, that intensity is just loosened, it's diluted. There is a relaxation of it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jay Griffiths about her book, A Country Called Childhood. Now, Indigenous communities, as much as you show in your book that they have often created much more humane and soul-creating rather than soul-destroying container for childhood, it's not always like that. You talk about traditional Inuit societies in the Arctic where the position of girls is horrendous, where, you know, they're free up until the age of maybe seven, you know, where there was, you know, at the age of seven, they begin to lose their autonomy. And by the time they're 14, they're married and they have no choice in who they marry. And in fact, if they try to rebel, they can be, you know, severely punished by society, cast out by society. So I wonder, what is the lesson of that for us? Is it just that you can say, well, there's some cultures that do this and some cultures that don't do that? But in this case, I mean, the Inuit culture is one which has, you show as an example of many of the wonderful things you talk about. And then there's how they treat their girls. Of course, there are cultures that come on top of hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. I mean, they are more natural And yet there are things in them that, you know, I'm like so glad that our children are not growing up like that.
Yes, this is really serious. And this is why in my book I've detailed, you know, at some length the experience of girls in some indigenous societies, female genital mutilation. You know, the lack of choices, as you mentioned, traditionally in Inuit marriages for girls. These are things that I have absolutely no wish to ignore. I couldn't agree more. But what I'd also say is that there's too often a lack of understanding about why certain cultural practices happened, and much, much more to the point, a lack of knowledge about our own history. So when I write about female infanticide in traditional Arctic communities, this is absolutely because the climate is so, so, so tough. The margins of survival are narrow, like Bible paper narrow. And when there was no food, when the hunting wasn't good, when the weather had been so bad that people couldn't move, couldn't eat, is that, yes, they had to make terrible decisions about killing the youngest and the girls as babies so that the food that there was could keep the hunters alive. These are cruel, terrible masks, because the girls wouldn't be hunters. It would be the boys who would grow up to be hunters. The girls would be the sowers and the mothers.
But isn't that basically saying that women and girls don't have the same survival value? And I don't think that's actually true. I mean, anthropologically, I think it's, well, maybe the Inuits are different, but I think that women and girls are just as important, and in many ways often more important to the survival of a band, of a tribe, than the men, because how many animals can you actually hunt, whereas being able to gather, being able to have children are fundamental to the survival of a culture.
In the Arctic, there is no gathering. This matters. All the food traditionally is hunted. The women's job in terms of survival that is most crucial is sewing. So a famous Inuit curse is, your mother does not know how to sew. But I think what's important is that this isn't an easy choice. This isn't something which is done out of wanting to commit infanticide. It is done because the maths is so cruel that something which nobody wants to do would be done in order to keep the hunters alive.
And yet I think it's not just the Inuit. Many, many traditional cultures and modern cultures, I mean cultures throughout history, have denigrated women, have controlled women, have controlled their sexuality, still control their sexuality. You know, not a really great survival tactic. I don't think we can go to that. I think it has to do with something else. And maybe we're really getting off on a tangent.
One of the things that people often don't realize about the Western tradition is that actually we've also committed infanticide in huge numbers ourselves, and for the same reasons, when the maths of survival demanded. There's this terrible, sad statistic about the Foundling Hospital in London in 1710. The first 4 years that it opened, they had 15,000 children dumped on their doorstep, and 10,000 of them died. And this was not because people wanted to commit infanticide any more than in the Arctic. It was because people were unable to keep those children. Mm-hmm. And I think these things, you know, these things have to be put in context. But I do think without question that what you're saying about, which is why in my book I've included several pages about the treatment of girls as being different and infinitely worse in many indigenous societies, not all, but in many indigenous society, because it has to be looked at, it has to be confronted.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jay Griffiths about her book, A Country Called Childhood, Children and the Exuberant World.
We talked about surveillance, and you mentioned Laura Decker. It's not just surveillance, but also the monitoring of children, the control of children wandering. She's a marvelous example. Tell us who Laura Decker was. What happened when she wanted to go off on her worldwide tour?
Laura Decker. Now, Laura Decker is somebody that I have to say, you know, I think Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn would have fought a duel over Laura Decker. When she was born on a boat, she always wanted to sail. Her parents were on this enormous years-long sailing trip. At 13, she wanted to sail solo around the world. Her father thought that she should do it, was quite happy for her to do it. She was extremely self-reliant, extremely capable.
She had her own boat already when she was a young child.
She did. And so she attempted to set off because she wanted the record of being the youngest person to sail solo around the world. But she was basically stopped by the Dutch authorities. The Office of Compulsory Schooling, you know, it's like that's double dullness, isn't it? And they stepped in, they made themselves co-guardians of her. Her father was also a guardian. They went to court to stop her doing it, although she didn't attend one court case because she'd gone sailing instead. She attempted at one point to start off and sail to Britain, but the port authorities basically, you know, captured her and insisted that her father came and escorted her home. And her father, first of all, said, no, she's perfectly able to do it on her own. This was a very interesting story. This was about somebody who was, in effect, behaving at an age that in this era and this culture is absolutely unheard of, to try to do something like that so young. But in the history of childhood, it is not uncommon. It is not unheard of. You know, William Wordsworth was off wandering the mountains in the middle of winter when he was 9. Nobody made a big fuss about it. But yet in Britain a few years back, there was a story about an 8-year-old boy who got lost in the woods for one night. It was October. It was Britain. What can happen? Not a lot. And there was this huge song and dance about how he had managed to survive. You know, children have been doing this and teenagers have been doing this for a very long time. You know, Henry II, when he was a teenager, left without his parents' permission, left and failed to take 2 minor castles. There are stories of teenagers left, right and centre. You know, one Scottish teenager aged 13, you know, almost casually his grandson was writing his memoir and saying almost casually, yes, he went to sea when he was 13, he lied about his age, he had no sea boots. That's what children were willing and able to do.
I think of my grandfather, who sailed from Minsk, near Minsk in Russia, to the United States by himself at the age of 12 and began working. I mean, he did have family here, but he was an independent child, and when he got here, he began to work. I mean, that was common. It wasn't even remarked upon.
I think that's really interesting, because what I have to say is that when I think of my godchildren and my nephews, if I think of them doing something like that, age 12, I feel probably like every parent does. I want to throw my arms around them and say, no, it's going to be too dangerous. But the reason why I'm writing these things in my book is because what I want to do is to open up the debate, is to open up the sense for people to have a much wider understanding of the possibilities, the strengths of children, the competences of children. They are more competent and can be much more competent than we give them credit for.
And also you say in your book, Jay Griffiths, In a Country Called Childhood, you say that children need chance. They need risk. I mean, that's pushing it even a little bit further. What about that need for that?
Yes, to me, this is a very political issue. If you've got a society which basically tells people from such an early age, as our society does with small children, you must obey the authorities, you can't do anything on your own. I went to a bonfire night in my town. There was this huge fire. It's a rural place. The farmers put their fences. It was huge, you know, flames running like roof height. And there was this sign at child's eye view saying, stand back, danger, as if the children were supposed to take their authority from these signs and not use their own judgment about whether or not this burning pyre was safe to go near. And what it does is it teaches children to obey. So children are not so much being beaten into obedience, they're being eroded into it. They're being told at every point, you're not allowed to do this, you must ask permission for that, you can't do that without a chit of paper that says that you can, have you got permission from the authorities for this, that and the other, rather than being encouraged to trust their own sense of what's safe and what's dangerous, rather than learning for themselves what risk is, what chance is. Children have to have a working relationship with risk and chance. Life is a chancy thing. As soon as they're grown up, they're going to have to deal with these things, and it's better that they start learning younger. But it's also a political thing. If you teach a whole generation that they must obey the commands of others at every turn, what you're doing is you're creating a society which is docile, which is malleable, which is obedient. Now, at its absolute worst, and I'm not saying that telling your children to stand back from a fire is the same as fascism, but what I really would question is how deep that sense of obedience goes in childhood. Because if you look at the history of fascism, what you find, Alice Miller, Hannah Arendt, the experiments of Milgram and all those famous things looking at what it was in the German population that led to fascism, what all of these point to is obedience over everything else, so that all of the work of Alice Miller, psychoanalyst Alice Miller, absolutely brilliantly uncovers the layers of obedience in childhood, totalitarian fatherhood, the sense of the way that children and young people couldn't have their own will, couldn't trust their own judgment, were being taught to obey even when their own conscience was against it. Stanley Milgram pointed this out so perfectly. It's absolutely fascinating to me that now we're encouraging a culture where people are supposed to obey the commands of authority without realizing this has a terrible political hinterland. And all that I'm doing is saying caution.
Well, that and more are the really profound questions that you ask in your book. It's a wonderful book, A Country Called Childhood, beautifully written, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much.
In addition to A Country Called Childhood, Jay Griffiths is the author of several books, including Wild and Elemental Journey and Savage Grace. Now, let's listen to an edited clip from a TED Talk given by Laura Decker, the youngest person ever to sail around the globe by herself.
So at the age of 14, I left from the south of Europe alone, went to the Canary Islands, Cape Verde, onto the Caribbean, learning that a home, for some reason, doesn't really clean itself. All right, so you actually got to do the laundry. How does that work? Cooking food? Spaghetti? So yes, no fridge in the boat, no shower in the boat, just basic navigation, because I don't like sponsors. I don't like people telling me where to go and what to do. Well, that means you have to do everything yourself. Well, I learned really quickly. I cooked for myself, I did the laundry for myself, there were no people when I got ashore, so I had to repair everything myself as well. And, well, through the Caribbean, onto the Pacific, to the top of Australia. By that time, I had sailed quite a bit, and I knew the boat quite well. So I wanted to have the next challenge. I sailed from Australia to South Africa without stopping, 6,000 nautical miles, 48 days. Why? Just because I wanted it. I thought I would just go for it. If it doesn't work out, I'll just go and sail to an island. There will probably be enough rain, so I can drink. I'll be fine. So I just went for it. And that was one of the greatest trips ever. Because to be out there, just with nature, mentally, that trip was awesome. Because I got to know myself so well. And I got to fulfill this dream that I'd had. I had set my goals and I just went for it.
And that was Laura Decker. You can get a link to her entire TED Talk by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.